Good morning for those joining. It's July the 10th, 2022. We're in the 13th chapter, I think the 36th verse of the Acts of the Three Neophytes. We could use someone catching me. Do we have somebody could do a recap a little bit of last week? Or be willing to try?
It seems like we had kind of talked about the Dark Ages and that we were getting ready to come up to like Christopher Columbus time period in the allegory. I don't have a whole lot to say. Someone else wants to do a better job.
But as it progresses, it'll become obvious where it's coming from. Let me start off reading with 36. And it came to pass that the Lord of the vineyard saith unto his servant, let us go down into the lower parts of the vineyard to see whether the natural branches also produce forth evil fruit. And it came to pass that they saw that the fruits of the natural branches were corrupted also because of that abominable church, yea, the first and the second, and also the last. And all the churches that had tried to bring forth good fruit had been corrupted. But behold, the Lord of the vineyard then said to his servant, this is the fulfillment of the vision of Nephi concerning that man whom he saw that was separated from the seed of his brethren by the many waters. And I saw that the Spirit of God came down and inspired that man. And as the man went through the many waters, he came to the seed of his brethren, which was in the land of the promise, just as he saw in the Spirit, just as he saw the Spirit of God inspire other Gentiles, which are branches of the wild olive tree, and therefore remnant of the house of Israel. They went forth out of captivity and crossed over the many waters and received the good land by inheritance, for they humbled themselves before God, before the Lord, and the power of the Lord was with them. And this is a recounting of Christopher Columbus, correct?
You know, I was listening to, what's his name? Wayne. Anyway, there was another guy who discovered the New England area. So I'm not so sure that it was Christopher. There was another guy that came even earlier. You know, Christopher Columbus discovered a little lower down in the island, kind of more what we'd call not really North America, but down lower. But anyway, I just, I'll see if I can find that link and I'll just put it in the comments, but I found his video. It's about 30 minutes long, very interesting on this particular time period. I'll put it in the comments if any of you guys want to look at it. He's, he promotes the idea that the Nephites were generally first landed in Florida and then went on up all the way up to the Great Lakes. He's more of that area kind of guy versus, you know, if you talk to John Pratt, he would say, oh no, he's down in the more South America area. Anyway, it's, I happened to watch that this week and found it very interesting. And I'll just put that in the comments. And then if you guys see that, you can copy it and then look at it later. But I forget the guy's name, but to me, he did all of the New England area and he preached a religion. Anyway, it was interesting, but anyway, I digress.
Is his name Wayne May?
I'll toss that out.
Wayne May. Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah. Wayne May.
Yeah.
I'll put the link in the comments. And then if you want it, you just copy it and look at it later. But it just one of the things I watched this week and said, that's cool. That's interesting.
In the LDS church has been taught that it is Columbus, because I wrote down next to the verse in the Book of Mormon, Columbus. So probably that is taught in the LDS church that in 1 Nephi 13, verse 12. what the footnote is.
If I just make a comment, there's been some controversy because, I mean, there's a lot of people that think it were more like some Vikings, like that it was actually that group of people that came to the Americas first. And I don't know that it really matters specifically. I think the point is that just the way I read that people came and that they knew that this was the fulfillment because this is the promised land, right? I mean, all that is interesting.
And didn't the Vikings come through Alaska, though, up that way? Not down to Florida.
Mm-hmm. But just my point is that, like, it's, to me, like, what this is talking about is that people came to this promised land. And I don't know that it's so important whether it was the Columbus group or the Vikings is what my point is. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and it actually says that right in this verse. It says he inspired the man, and then as the man went through the many waters, he came to the seed of his brethren, which is in the land of promise, just as he saw the Spirit of God inspire other Gentiles, which are the branches of the wild olive tree. So I think he's inspiring, God is inspiring a lot of people.
Right. Good point. Yeah, it's right there in front of us. Okay, thanks.
Does anybody have any comments where earlier in that it talks about the first and the second and also the last?
I was also wondering about that. Yeah.
Anybody have any light they'd like to shine on that?
No, to catch Brother Cackler up, we're on verse 36 in
Acts
14.
Okay, thank you. Hello, Brother Lynn.
Bob.
Good to see you.
How you doing, Brother Bob? It's good to see you.
Plus, it's good to see everyone else. I'll be right back.
I had considered they were talking about other churches that they had tried, other plantings that they had tried to do. But now that's just my best guess.
Could it be the first church, like in Jerusalem, maybe, and then the second one, and maybe the first one would have been Jesus and the second one, like thinking of dispensations, maybe.
I don't know.
Do we have a recording of what John said about this verse?
Yeah, but I'm not sure if he mentions this.
I haven't really noticed that before, but it is.
Yeah, I'll pick up on it just this time, and it'll be, let's ponder on that and talk about it.
Yeah.
What it means.
I never really paid attention or noticed it before either.
Well, you know, on John's article, he says the first visit was during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. That was 605 BC. The second visit was a long time later during the meridian of time when the Savior came to the earth. The third visit was the new tree planted to supplement in the choice area. I guess that was in the Americas. The fourth visit, a long time after the second, but not after the third, our current era. So anyway, I think I get confused, but I think we're either talking about the second or the third visit. Of course, anyway, John lumps it into five visits, and which helped me sort through a lot. You know, one of the things I thought was really interesting about the Yellow Book and also this allegory is that the leaders, the main leaders, and now I go blank now, the three leaders, the one that had his tomb, and anyway, I found that very interesting how that fit in with the New Testament narrative. That anyway, I'll turn the time back to Steve. I'm just rambling through here some of my thoughts.
Maybe John did make some a conversation about this. I guess Russell may be the only way to access that. He's not here today, so I may make a note to ask him. Let me do that.
His article about this should be on his page on johnpratt.com.
We talked about the first, the second, and the last that failed.
Where he's the article that Dewey's talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Would somebody like to read 37?
I will. I'll read 37. But these last grafted branches, that is, Gentiles, brought to this land overseas, will also surmount the seed of Lehi and his brethren, and the branch of the seed of his brethren will dry up and die, and the Lord will cry for his loss, because all the fruit of his vineyard will perish except these, but now are also corrupted. And all the trees of his vineyard are of no avail except to be cut down and cast into the fire.
Is this saying there's no other, that the tree's gone, there's no vineyard anymore?
I think this might be talking about, grafted branches, so these Gentiles, be it pilgrims or the Columbus or whoever, they're brought to this land oversea and they're going to overtake the Lamanites and the Nephites and stuff, right?
Right.
And then everything is kind of gets corrupted.
Well, it's interesting about the cast into the fire because we watched a little bit of the lesson that, that's on the second invitation and you had an interesting comment, Steve, about your farmer heritage that you used to burn down the field, but yeah. Still the roots would still be intact. So that's interesting that will come later because, those roots are important to take up the, the water. So even if they are corrupted, but those roots are very important and they're all planted all across the world. We had a feeling that those are the people that are believing in the sealed book. So that was my comment. So they will still be intact.
So he's talking in 37 about the pilgrims and those after them that will overcome the remnant of the Lamanites, the Nemanah or whoever, or whatever is there, and that he's sorrowed by this. And he talks about all the trees of his vineyard are of no avail except to be cut down and cast into the fire. Is he speaking of times later leading up to Joseph Smith?
Yeah, because Joseph Smith, that's the other tree that's mentioned in verse 38. At least that's what was talked about in the lesson with John.
Well, I wondered if he could be talking about us now that the vineyard has become corrupt. We're not producing good feelings and good fruit anywhere. And it's about to be burned in our day. And we're the ones that are about to become stubble. Anyway, that was kind of what I was thinking.
Well, I thought on the same line. Sorry.
I'm trying my best to have the good feelings. It's a challenge, but yeah, because of the sealed book, we now have like a handbook to try and have these good feelings. At least this is what I am learning from the sealed book. So there is hope, Dewey.
We at least know now.
Yes, we at least know now.
There's no quick fix. We've got these things to overcome, and in time will temper us, but at least we have a path that's clear.
I'd like to go more time here to the beginning of the verse. I'm going to read it. But these last gathered branches, and overseas of the building here, also surmount the seed of Lehi, which we did take over. And the branch of the seed of his brother will dry up and die. Kind of sad what's happened to the Native Americans today. You know, they've been put on reservations and given welfare, and they're having a hard time maintaining their tribes because of what, what we've done to them. And it's like, so reading this verse is that both the Lamanites are going to have a hard time, and the pilgrims, the Gentiles. In this vineyard. Not all of them, I don't think, but the whole crowd. So you have the Native American.
I couldn't hear him. How about you all? I couldn't hear Lynn.
I think his internet connection is not very good, but no. I think the gist of what he was saying, that he believes it's the Native Americans, that what's going on right now, how they're kind of dying off. Lynn, your internet's really bad, I guess. We're having a hard time.
Maybe you should turn out your video. Maybe that's better. I don't know. Sometimes that's better to only hear the audio.
I'm on a hotspot, so I don't got a very good connection.
All right. Any other comments on that? Valky, would you like to read that?
Yep. But behold, the Lord of the vineyard cut off the trees that obstructed this piece of land and planted another tree in his place, fulfilling the promise which Joseph, the son of Jacob, had obtained from God the Father, when he told him that he would raise from his loins a fair branch to the house of Israel, and being righteous, though he is Gentile, will be counted as being part of the natural olive tree, for he will be truly a descendant of Joseph, not the Messiah, but that graft of which Lehi prophesied, which is to come in the fullness of the Gentiles in the last days, when your descendants have generated, fallen into unbelief, yea, for the space of many years and for many generations after the Messiah manifests himself in person to the children of men, then the fullness of my gospel shall come to the Gentiles, and of the Gentiles to the remnant of your descendants. So yeah, I think that the other tree is referring to Joseph Smith. At least that's what I got from the lesson on the second invitation.
I think you're right. I think that's what makes sense to me, is that it's Joseph Smith Jr.
And you know, the descendants, I mean, think about how the church took off in South America and in Mexico. I mean, the descendants of the Lamanites, I mean, the churches flourished in those areas. And, you know, a lot of times I'm always thinking, oh, it's got to be the native Indians. But, I mean, the Lamanites must have spread out, you know, all over the place. And I think a lot of them have been found in South America. And that might be the descendants now that, you know, Joseph Smith has brought the gospel to them. Anyway, that's kind of how I'm interpreting it. I'll pass.
Well, that's how I interpret it. And then, I mean, it leads to Brazil too, because there's a lot of members in Brazil. I mean, you know, that joined the LDS, you know, so in a lot of ways they've been prepared to receive more, right? Isn't there, how many LDS temples are in Brazil? Isn't there like 6 or 7?
Yeah, they just announced a new one, I believe. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So.
Also, okay. Though, along with what he's saying is that, Philip Landis, Cloud Piler, with one of the transcribers of the book, Demon Hall Record, I communicate with a little bit, and they have people and remnants and descendants all over South America. I asked him because I was curious that maybe we could gain some knowledge of the local and natural medicines that they used for healing. But they have some, and they have tribal meetings and they have council meetings and things that come together. I didn't get a lot more from him than that, but I was hoping to find some of them next door down there. Wouldn't hurt to know what those plants do. I wouldn't recognize them. Any more comments? Susan, would you like to read 39, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yea, to bring the Gentiles out of the darkness which shall be upon the earth in those days, nevertheless, this graft will be a seer who will guide my people again to the path of light. So that's pretty straightforward.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Do you want me to read 40?
Yes, please.
Okay. And the Lord of the vineyard saw that a part of this planted tree in the last days produced good and bad fruit, that it was good and bad feelings in the people who make up the branches of his vineyard in such a way that the brave branch produced bad fruits that surpassed the good branch. And now, after all the cares we have taken with the vineyard, its grafts have become corrupt, so that none of them bring forth good fruit. And these I hope to keep in order to get its fruit from me for the season to come. Okay.
I think that might be where we're at generally. So none of them bring forth good fruit. In other words, Joseph Smith came, got the restoration going, it spread out, and then we all became proud and stopped producing good fruit, so that none of them brought forth good fruit. And so I wonder if that isn't our day, because, you know, we're about, basically, we're about to be destroyed again. I mean, that's the whole message of Isaiah, that 90% of the earth is going to be removed here in the next 10 years. So that's what makes me think that in general, we are not producing the kind of fruit that the Savior's happy with, or only a remnant of us are. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're, you know, in Utah, I know a ton of people that I consider holy, and their countenance looks wonderful, but compared to the whole world, it's just a few humble followers of Christ, you know, compared to the world. And even here, you know, money and things and big homes, and there have been a lot of things that have caused the LDS to lose their way as of these, you know, in the last 20 years. And so anyway, I don't think there's a lot of us compared to the world. I think it's a small remnant that will be saved. And I'm hoping it will be among them. I'm hoping, and I'll pass.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that sentence about now, after all the care we had taken with the vineyard, I mean, you can put this in any dispensation. There was great care by the Lord to keep the vineyard going. And he's like, after everything we've done, we still have all this corruption. And if you look, so this is verse 40, and at the very end of it, it says, I hope to keep in order to get the fruits for me for the season to come. If you look back over, so there's 26, well, 25 and 26 and 27, the end of each one of those talks, the Lord is saying, keep them for the proper season, and I will bring them to me, that I may bring them unto me, and keep them for the due season, that I may preserve them for myself. And there's one that says, I will bring those who will serve me. And there's in 31, the end of it says, behold, the time draweth near, and the end shall come soon. Therefore, I must save fruit for myself for the next season. So, yeah, I think we are the section that the Lord is talking about, that he is bringing forth at this time to do the last bits of work that he needs to have done. It's just my thought.
It goes on to talk about, I think Dewey's right, where this is all, these next few verses is all about us right now. And if we keep going, we can learn a little bit more about why it's happening to us. And there's a, I guess in, yeah, the end of 41, I think we should keep going on 41, because it's going to talk a little bit about the problem.
Sister Darla, would you like to read 41?
Excuse me. But behold, they became like the wild olive tree, and they are of no use except to be cut down and cast into the fire. But I feel sorry to lose them, just like the rest of my vineyard. What else could, however, have I done in my vineyard? I have nourished them. I have digged about them. I have pruned and I have fertilized its roots. I have stretched forth mine hand almost all the days long. But behold, the end draw nigh, and I therefore I feel I have to cut down all the trees in my vineyard and cast them into the fire, that they may be burned. Who is it that has corrupted my vineyard?
Any comments?
I think it's Satan that's corrupted the vineyard.
There's a really, really important verse, an important footnote right there that takes us to Jacob 5, 46 through 47 in the LDS. I don't have my Book of Mormon with me. Does someone have theirs that they could pull it up and read those verses?
Yeah, I can read them. Jacob 5, verse 46. And now, behold, notwithstanding all the care which we have taken of my vineyard, the trees thereof have become corrupted, that they bring forth no good fruit. And these I had hoped to preserve, to have laid up fruit thereof against the season, unto mine own self. But behold, they have become like unto the wild olive tree, and they are of no worth but to be hewn down and cast into the fire. And it grieved me that I should lose them. Verse 47. But what could I have done more in my vineyard? Have I slackened mine hand that I have not nourished it? Nay, I have nourished it, and I have digged about it, and I have pruned it, and I have dunged it, and I have stretched forth mine hand almost all the day long, and the end draweth nigh. And it grieved me that I should hew down all the trees of my vineyard, and cast them into the fire, that they should be burned. Who is it that has corrupted my vineyard?
Oh, does it stop there? What's the next verse? I think it says who it is.
Okay, verse 48. And it came to pass that the servant said unto his master, it is not the loftiness of thy vineyard. Have not the branches thereof overcome the roots which are good? And because the branches have overcome the roots thereof, behold, they grew faster than the strength of the roots, taking strength unto themselves. Behold, I say, is not this the cause that the tree of thy vineyard have become corrupted?
All right, so is it not the loftiness? It's not the pride. It is the pride, I guess.
It's the pride, clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly the pride.
And I love the Nemenha record talks about this so much, that it's this love of possessions, the love of, we think we own the land, try to get more, get gain, all those things. That's what's causing this pride. Mm-hmm. So we need to repent.
I remember when Abram was talking about when he translated Isaiah 28, and you know, Isaiah 28 says, woe to the drunkards of Ephraim, and their crowning splendor has become a fading wreath on the heads of the opulent. And he says, well, you really should translate that fat and proud ones, but he decided to be nice and say the opulent, overcome with wine, overcome with the things of the world. But that really is a big problem with the LDS in the United States. You know, basically we were righteous and then we prospered, and then we became proud, and that's kind of where we're at, you know, is that cycle. And we're on the pride cycle, where we're about to get whacked, so to speak.
We're going to get whacked.
It's a footnote.
I love it. Lisa, Jeannie, I don't know, Steve, probably... Well, do you guys remember the talk that Ezra Taft Benson gave on pride? Do you remember that one?
Yeah, and that was clear back, what, like,
that was
15 years ago?
Yeah, and I remember, I mean, that was just, I just remember going like, wow, I am so prideful. Like, because he just broke it down in so many different ways of that you typically don't think of pride. But anyway, if you want to be humble, go reread that talk.
That was long before they ever came out with the new Mercedes red coupe, shiny. I mean, talk about the cool things you can worship now, or, you know, the 4,000 square foot house. Some of my kids have, I mean, there are, anyway,
well, yeah.
There's so many things that can take you out.
Yeah. Well, and it's even like the pride of getting caught up in like even like sports teams and competition. I mean, there's so many ways that we can get caught up in just like pointless pride, you know. So anyway,
let's not forget the pride of thinking we have the only true church that all of us were raised in. You know, thinking that that everyone else is wrong and we're right. That's, I think, another huge, huge thing. We have to be humble.
I would agree that, and that gets really obnoxious because that is so contrary to humility. Because, you know, there's truth like in all things. And that's what kind of blows my mind a lot, is because that's what Joseph Smith, one of the main things that I remember about studying him and what I believe his character was, is that he told us to seek truth in all things. You know, he wasn't like, you know, just like the Nemanjah record and all these other things, that, you know, he was very much seek it in all, you know. I mean, Buddhism has really beautiful principles of chastity. So I agree. That's definitely a prideful attitude.
If history has not taught us anything about pride, is that men's hearts don't require a lot of help toward gravitating toward pride, vanity, and bringing down the world to mortal idolship. I think the more that, at least my experience has been, the more I get focused on what we're being taught in the sealed book with our feelings and the greater feelings and the differences about where those two take us, the more I'm trying to focus the best I can to stay here, the more obvious some of these other things that I never really paid attention to have become, like the effects of TV and the commercials and the things. It's just a constant bombardment. And I'm looking at the kids and I'm listening to what they're listening to. And I'm like, wow, it is incredible. And then to put that together with most of that is, you know, envy and pride, greed, and, you know, TV shows that are full of darkness in every corner. There's certainly a war going on. And right now,
and then it
looks outnumbered, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also the other piece that has just been more recent, is with all the social media, like everyone is doing the comparison of everybody else's life, and the kids are posting this and that, and the girls are using filters, you know, to make themselves look like model perfect. And, you know, it's just so, it's just all so fake and so prideful. And yeah, it's.
Well, I'm sorry, Suzanne, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, you know, we definitely are in the end times, but again, we have to hold on to the hope that we know who's going to win in the end. And we're going to get whacked, Dewey, for sure. But we have to have a hope that, you know, God's will is going to overcome in the end. So yeah, I'm done, Jeannie. Go ahead.
I was just thinking, you know, so much of all that is, everything you said, Steve and Suzanne, is so true. So why is it that the pompous pride of the LDS church doesn't address these things, doesn't teach us better? And yet I've run into people who say, this is the true church and nobody else is right. Well, you're not right either. Just think of what you're teaching your children. But I have also, then I heard this one lady say, I have prayed and prayed and prayed that the prophet, quote unquote, of the LDS church, which I don't know who it is really. I can't remember his name. I prayed to know that he was a true prophet and carried the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And if you're telling me that there's another prophet, because there can't be two on the earth at the same time, well, then I can't ever pray again, because I received confirmation that that LDS prophet was true. So there can't be another one. And if you're saying that's true, then I can't pray. I've lost everything about God that I know, and I might as well crawl in a hole. And I was just like, that's a shock that your brain would say that to you. That kind of means you don't believe God is there at all. Anyway, I'm rambling.
Do you know, the thing is, every event, whether it was Jeremiah's time or Nephi's time, whenever Israel was going to be destroyed, there was always a whole bunch of prophets that rose up and started talking. Whether the main guy became quiet, there still would rise up among the people a bunch of prophets that would say, we're going to get whacked. And so, and I think that's happening. It's happening in a lot of circles. So I think there are a lot of voices out there that are, and the other thing I was thinking is, think how much it would, how your life would change if you followed the Davidic servant out to the Nevada desert and hung out there for 42 months before you went back to the New Jerusalem. I mean, who would do that? Who would have enough faith to do that? Or wherever it is, you know, the Nevada desert happens to be close to where I'm at, but wherever they go to avoid the atom bombs and destruction, that's going to take a lot of faith. And you have to leave everything behind. You're not going to be able to haul your all your stuff. At least, I don't know how you're going to do it without gasoline. So anyway, that's one thing that I guess all of you guys might ask yourself is, do I have enough faith to go follow somebody into the desert? And there's no water out there. You know, how am I going to survive? You know, as I understand it, and I've been told for 10 years that I would do that. And so, and even after all of that, and, you know, I have it journaled all over in my sacred writings, even after all that, I still ask myself, do I really have enough faith to follow somebody out in the Nevada desert or wherever it is? Because, you know, after all the revelations, I probably had 100 of them on that. And yet I honestly ask myself, do you really have enough faith to go do that? And anyway, I just pass that on as my own personal doubts and fears. And I'm done.
May I comment?
Absolutely.
Brother Dewey, can you make plans to come to the November conference in Brazil? I think your whole being will change.
I've been pondering it. I don't have my passport yet. That's probably the one big deal. I do have the $5,000 that I could pull that off. But I've been pondering it.
You'd be most welcome here. The people will welcome you with open arms, and I think your presence here would help the whole church faith to grow.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I've told this story a few times, but about 5 years ago, somebody phoned me up and says, "You don't know who I am, but you're going to be going through the places of refuge." And when he spoke to me and my wife, man, the spirit just burned in our chest for 8 hours as he was telling us. And but basically, and he said, "You will go in spaceships and move stuff around back and forth." This is before I knew about Mauricio and Moroni and Moroni's ship. Or, you know, I kind of knew Enoch would have ships. So at the time when he was telling me all this, I thought, well, hey, Enoch shows back up with spaceships, I'm all for that, you know, moving stuff around from place to place. But anyway, I would have totally just dismissed that if the spirit wasn't so strong when he was telling me that we would go through the cities of light and move stuff back and forth. We wouldn't build any temples, but we would be moving, you know, various communities will develop various things, and we would be moving stuff from place to place and with spaceships. And it, like I say, I might have burst out laughing if the spirit wasn't burning so much when he told me. And back, he had brought us down to the genealogy library, because I didn't have a temple recommend then, and he pointed out Eve that was working in the library and said she was a resurrected being, and I could kick myself now for not going up and shaking her hand, but at the time I was just so flabbergasted and so just knocked over that I just kind of looked at him and said, okay, you know, I'll just take that on faith. And so we're going to have to wait 5 years to find out the rest of that story. But anyway, I diverge.
Anybody else have any comments?
I wonder what the dash is about in 41. There's a dash.
Yeah, saw that. You know, I'm seeing dashes all over since Mauricio gave that great talk on the key. It's a key to more information. And now I see it all. In fact, last night I saw it four times in the third Nephi 20, where it talks about the Davidic servant. Gosh, I wish I had a Urim and Thummim and could look. Okay, there's a dash. Hover over that dash and let's find out what's missing there.
Do you think we've got time for one more?
Yes.
Yep. Who would like to do it? Volunteers.
I can read it.
Thank you.
42. And it came to pass that the Lord of the vineyard said unto the servant, "Let us go and hew down the trees of the vineyard and cast them into the fire, that they shall not cumber the ground of my vineyard, for I have done all I could. What could I have done more for my vineyard? But behold, the servant said unto the Lord of the vineyard, spare it a little longer. And the Lord said, yea, I will spare it a little longer, for it grieveth me that I should lose the trees of my vineyard." There's a lot of talk throughout the vineyard, this whole thing that talks about the servant. And I'm wondering if this could be the Davidic servant.
In the lesson with John, it was said that the servant is usually the prophet.
Well, I'll tell you that Abram Gileadi believes that it's the Davidic servant. And there's a place where the Lord goes and says to the servant, go get other servants. And so then he goes forth and starts calling the 144,000. And so now the previous servants, I think are different people. But in our day, in this time, I believe that that servant is the Davidic servant. And, you know, the same servant who will be second in command in the political kingdom and will be the same David that restores the Jerusalem temple, rebuilds the temple and converts some of the Jews and then brings them over to America. So I toss that on as that's my understanding of the servant in this. I guess this is the fourth time coming to the vineyard. But anyway, they may be, I think they're different servants myself personally, depending on the time period.
Bob, have you got anything you'd like to add about that? 42.
Oh, about the servant?
Yes.
Well, I was just going back and rereading this. You know, I thought it was Jesus Christ was the servant in many places here. But, you know, can I make another comment? And can I avoid answering that one?
Sure.
You know, the feeling that I get when I read this, study this, sometimes is almost like a feeling of defeat. I don't understand it. And so I went back and you read, there's a prophecy in verse number 4 that I think is important for, you know, the scholars of the church have attempted to interpret this for me and tell me what it means, but I'm still lacking. My understanding still lacking. But in the last part of verse 4, it says, now that you can understand in its simplicity this analogy uttered by my servant Zenas with regard to good feelings from God to his children on earth. And so I'm thinking that that's coming true as we study this, that we're understanding how important good feelings are. We may not understand, at least I don't understand, all the symbolism and the events and the chronology of this prophecy, but I was wondering, why did Jesus take time to explain it when he didn't really explain it? You know, and so I'm thinking, well, what he's saying is that we've got to really understand the power of the good feelings and the stewardship that goes with that. I don't know how else to explain it, but certainly the Lord doesn't want us to feel defeated and bewildered when we study this. We should be elated that we are understanding how good feelings are taking place in this parable. I don't know if I expressed my thoughts right, but maybe you got part of the idea of what I'm trying to say.
Well, I was going to say that if you go to Jacob 5 and start around verse 68 or so, but in 70 it says, and it came to pass the Lord of the vineyard, so that's Jesus, sent his servant. So that's another guy, a separate guy. And before that, he commands that servant to go out and get other servants. So right around, so Jacob 5 from about verse 65 on, you'll see what I'm talking about. And that's where my understanding is the Davidic servant, who I testify to you as a believer in the yellow book, will call forth other servants and then they will bring people to the New Jerusalem. Now, bringing people to the New Jerusalem, it's not far away, at least from, you know, from what the Lord has told me, it is within 8 years. So this gathering is, anyway, this is not far away. You guys should be able to see this happen right before your eyes. That's, at least that's how I, what the Lord has told me.
Can you guys hear me on this?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. I'm beginning to believe that this servant is Joseph Smith, because he was given the keys from Moses in, I think, chapter 110 in the LDS version, to gather all of the tribes of the house of Israel. And his keys would be, it said that his keys would be kept with him in his days and in the next realm, which means that it would never leave him. So he would have to, in one way or another, come back and do that, Joseph Smith. And then I think there was a parable in Doctrines and Covenants, and maybe one of the 90th chapters or the early 100 chapters. I was just reading it. But the Lord had described, I think, either the same or a similar parable, where the servant who sent out to gather everybody was Joseph Smith, and he had said that. So I'm starting to believe it could be Joseph Smith, or a form of him.
To redeem the vineyard.
Right, because he still has to finish. Right, he still has to finish his job, and his keys will never be taken from him to do that job. So he would have to come back in one form or another to complete that. That's my comment.
Good comment.
Yeah, and in DNC 90, I think I pasted that last week, in all of your lives, it's plural. In DNC, he's talking to Joseph Smith and saying that he'll have the authority. And then it says, in all of your lives, plural, you'll be over the kingdom. And so he may not be called Joseph in this next time, or you may not recognize. Anyway, I have to. There was a book written a few years back called Eternal Lives, and it shows all the places where multiple mortalities is taught, and it's. Unbelievable, all the places. When I read that book, I went, man, how come this doctrine has been hit, nobody has discovered, but I think it's only now that this doctrine now is coming forth, more and more light, realizing that, you know, even if you come on the earth and you make your calling and election, sure, well, great. Well, then what happens? Well, the Lord will call you to go back on the earth as an angel and do a certain kind of work. Like the 144,000, Joseph Smith reached over and grabbed William Clayton's knee and said, you'll be one of the 144,000. And he mentioned several others in the 1800s who would be some of the 144,000. So, and as we know from the Yellow Book, people can come back on the earth. And so a lot of the people who brought about the restoration, I believe personally, will be back here again in another mortality as angels. They'll still be like just like us, but they'll be back gathering the elect. And I think that's a doctrine that is just now coming forth for us to ponder. Anyway.
What was the name of that book?
It's called Eternal Lives. I'll see if I can find it.
I think it's called The Doctrine of Eternal Lives, isn't it?
Yes, I think you're right. The doctrine of eternal lives. And, you know, it's taught, I guess the best place it's taught is in DNC 132, but most of the restoration, a lot of the restoration people don't accept that. But it talks about your eternal lives and eternal deaths. I just reread that section this week. But in a nutshell, I don't know if you can learn. Think of all the things you have to learn to be a god. I don't think you can do it in one mortality. There's just too much to learn. And I think Joseph Smith said, hey, even after this life, well, what will you do after this life? Well, chances are you'll serve in some capacity, whether that's with a mortal body or not. So, you know, you'll have another life. And another life until you, anyway, I find the doctrine very interesting and perhaps speculative, and I'll pass.
So staying in Duchesne for the many years, Kevin, who I call Cherokee Man, but you know, he works on Sundays, so he's never able to join us, but he has worked like Family Dollar and Gateway and plays this before he became a truck driver, and he met a lot of people and he kept account of all the people that didn't know why they moved to Duchesne, and many that said that they had been in another life with another name and another purpose. And he's talked to me a lot about that. The other person is that John has talked a lot about this in his book on the I think it's the clock. Well, it's the workings of the star maps. They show multiple personality, multiple eternal lives and the sacred round. And he wrote an article about multiple mortalities. And he said that this is the time frame that we're in now. He said, you will see, this was what John told me, you will see the multiple mortalities becoming very prevalent, and that it will be hard for many people with their traditional thinking to not be able to accept this. And he also talked several times about how he could see in Mauricio, the spirit of Joseph Smith.
We're about to run out of time. Lisa, did you want to stop the recording? That having been done,